So tonight I want to give a talk entitled Thoughts on Death and Dying. This is actually a big theme in the Buddhist teachings. I'm going to read sections of things from various suttas part of the way through. But before I do that, I'm sort of reflecting on why this is so important for me. I've given this talk before at other times. And partly I think it's, I'm starting to notice more and more. I don't know, if I read the New York Times, and there's always these notices in the New York Times that, you know, so-and-so, some rock musician or some famous artist or whatever, just passed away. And I don't sort of usually read the long articles, obituary things. But it's like I look at the ages and I go, oh wait, that person's was 3 years younger than me, or that person's was just a year older than me, or whatever. So I see, it catches my attention in that way. I had in my very young age, at 23, I was living on a communal farm. With a bunch of other hippies, which my father definitely did not approve of, to say the least. And but I had an uncle who was my dad's twin brother, actually. And he had a cottage on a lake very near where I was living. And we'd get together sometimes. And he and I got along really well. And I remember one time, you know, he came and picked me up, and I was at the cottage, just helping. It was in the fall. We're getting the floating dock in off the lakes and that sort of stuff. And, you know, sitting around in the evening, eating, and he had some good whiskey, and we were drinking. And he was quite a drinker and actually quite a heavy smoker as well. Anyhow, so I was there for a couple of days, and we were having a good time and talking about various things. And he was asking me, you know, he thought his generation had really failed getting things together, and maybe what was my generation going to do to, you know, I was a hippie and I was 23. What was my generation going to do to make things better? And then he gives me a ride back to the, I don't have a car, so he gives me a ride back to the farm. A couple hours later, I get a phone call from my father, which is like shocking to me that my father's phoning at all, to tell me that my uncle just passed away. I was like the last person to see him in the family. And it was like 2 hours after he was literally doing something, and the neighbors told me later, he was just doing something and he just fell over and he was gone. He had a massive heart attack just like that, 52 years old. And this for me was like the first encounter with like how sudden death can be and how it's like arbitrary in a way. It was like, what? This guy was like, we were just hanging out having a good time a couple hours ago, right? And then I got another phone call from my father, because this one I'm packing and getting ready to, you know, go to Toronto, which is where the family was. And he says, you know, someone in the family has to go and identify the body, because they have to do that legally. And, you know, instead of having your aunt or your cousin have to drive all the way up there and blah, 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 can you do this? Sure. So I actually have a couple of other friends drive me to the hospital. And there I go into where they keep bodies, right, the morgue. And he's just sort of lying there. He has his boots on still. He's all dressed up and he's got his outside clothes on, and it's like, wow. But he wasn't there anymore. Oh, this is what happens. Just like that. And so at that age of 23, I was already sort of like, I was stunned, but I was like grappling with, you know, what's going on. And so I've been doing that now for, that's over now, we're talking more than 50 years. This has been sort of a question that's been lying underneath my thoughts off and on through the rest of my life. So that's how I ended up giving this talk. I just want to sort of lead you into it. This is Mark Epstein's book, The Zen of Therapy. And he's talking about how we, in our culture, deal with death, which basically we're not very good at it. And we don't want to talk about it, which is part of the reason I do this talk, because I think we need to talk about this. We need to sort of be very open about this is what goes on, right? Anyhow, a good friend of mine from high school has just died after a 3-year battle with cancer, and we were visiting his wife several days later to bring her some food. Her son and daughter-in-law and their 2.5-year-old son are also there. We bring them bread from the bakery near us, chopped liver, an eggplant dip my wife had prepared, and a polenta and spinach casserole. Right? Because people bring food, right? We had a great wake for my uncle. I remember that. But lots of good food. After sitting and talking and eating, I get up to wash the dishes. The son and daughter-in-law are in the kitchen with me, and to my surprise, they can ask a professional question. What should we say to our son, they want to know. It has not occurred to me that the son would not yet know about his grandfather's death. I feel for their predicament. How are they to introduce death to their open, trusting, and loving child? He keeps asking, where's grandpa? They say, we told him he was away for a while. You didn't tell him anything yet, I inquire, stalling a bit, not yet knowing how to best say what I'm thinking. How come? I didn't see the point of ruining his perfect life, the father responds. It's up to you how you want to deal with it, I begin, knowing in my heart the boy's perfect life has already been disrupted. But I think you should just tell him the truth. How you phrase it depends on what you think, but I might say something like this. Grandpa died. His body couldn't go on any longer, so he had to let it go and get ready for the next one. I actually believe that, I continue, gathering steam. So it would be natural for me to phrase it that way. But what you say is less important than acknowledging the fact. He's going to sense that something has happened. He will hear conversation about it, and there's a funeral coming. And if you don't explain it, he will make something up about it that will be all the more confusing because you won't know what he is thinking. The worst thing would be that he feels your tension around it and your sadness at the loss, and he thinks it's because it was something he did. Kids feel what's going on around them, but they can't understand, and they make it be about them if you don't help to explain it. This is very hard for any of us to understand, and it certainly will be for him, but he will grow into it, and you can help him over the years. I mean, this is like brilliant advice, right? Not just for children. I mean, it's like, I think of all the euphemisms we have. I had a teacher from Australia, and she said she'd go home and her father, you know, once in a while to visit and her family in this town where they lived in Australia, and her father would say something about, well, you know, Mrs. So-and-so fell off her perch, which was a euphemism in Australia, I guess, for had just passed away. She fell off her perch, you know. And we say things like, we lost him. It's like, you know, he's just lost. We're going to go find him. He'll show up again, right? But no, we haven't lost him. He died. Right? But our whole culture just doesn't speak openly about this at all. The funeral industry is horrible for this sort of stuff. You know, dressing up corpses to look like, you know, as beautiful as they could possibly make them for no apparent reason other than it makes people less nervous. You know, it's I was with both my parents when they passed, and it's like There's just nothing there. They're gone, just like that. It's amazing. You know, when you, and I've done a lot of hospice work, so I sat with a lot of people as they died over the years. It's almost the same. It's quite a magical moment, actually. When you think about it, it's like there's this transition, like from one breath to the next. There's like, there's an inhale, there's an exhale, and then there's not another inhale. Just like that. It's always the same. Everybody. It's going to happen to everyone. But we don't want to think about it, and we don't want to talk about it. It's not like a polite conversation at a cocktail party to talk about this stuff, right? You'd be like, oh my God. Anyhow, I'm just a little bit of rant, but it's okay. So now I want to share some things from the sutta. And this is the Buddha talking about aging and death. And what is aging and death? What is the origin of aging and death? What is the cessation of aging and death? And what is the way leading to the cessation of aging and death? The aging of beings in the various orders of beings, their old age, brokenness of teeth, grayness of hair, wrinkling of skin, decline of life, weakness of faculties, that is called aging. The passing of beings out of the various orders of beings, their passing away, dissolution, disappearance, dying, completion of time, dissolution of the aggregates, laying down the body, this is called death. So this is aging and this is death, and what are called aging and death. With the arising of birth, there is the arising of aging and death. With the arising of birth, there is the arising of aging and death. It's built right into the system. Right? And you think about that, it's like, it's guaranteed. Because no one's going to sort of, we sort of pretend, well, that happens to other people, but not me. Or, I remember one time, I got a real lesson in impermanence. I won't tell you the whole story, but it was like, I thought I understood impermanence, but when it came right down to it, when the thought arose about something that I might not ever get to do it again, it was like, oh, no. I'll be around for another 20 years. Like, no, you're not. You don't know that, you know, that after the next breath, you know, I could be sitting here talking to you, and halfway through the talk, I could be gone. I don't know. We don't know. At all. We haven't got a clue about when it's going to happen at all. But it happens to all of us. You know, the causing of aging and death is birth. And then the Buddha talks about the classic thing that they, and this is in every culture, not just in our culture. And he's talking about, this is in the sutta where he's talking about how there's certain things he just, that people kept saying, well, what do you think about this? And what do you think about that? All these sort of sociological and spiritual debates that people were having in his culture at that time. And they couldn't, he just wouldn't let people pin him down. Therefore, remember what I have left undeclared is undeclared. And remember what I have declared is declared. And what I've left undeclared? The world is eternal. I've left undeclared. The world is not eternal. I've left undeclared. The world is finite. I've left undeclared. The world is infinite. I've left undeclared. These are like classic philosophical blah, blah, blah topics, right? Then he goes on. The soul is the same as the body. I've left undeclared. The soul is one thing and the body another. I've left undeclared. After death, the Tathagata exists. That's the Buddha exists. I've left undeclared. After death, the Tathagata does not exist. I've left undeclared. After death, the Tathagata both exists and does not exist. I have left undeclared. After death, the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. I have left undeclared. So these are the four possibilities that people debated. One of those four things had to be true, and he wouldn't say anything. Why have I left all this undeclared? Because it is unbeneficial. It does not belong to the fundamentals of the holy life. It does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge and enlightenment. Don't waste your time thinking about this stuff, because it's just a distraction from practice. Think how much time goes in our cultures, in every, and you can go across any culture, it doesn't matter. There's all this sort of thoughts and rituals and what's going to happen after death is like a huge thing. Like, you know, I'm going to be saved, I'm not going to be saved. I'm going to be reborn, I'm not going to be reborn. Who knows? And what he's saying is, don't waste any time thinking about this at all. It's just speculation. You don't know. You'll know the moment that things end and you shift to something else, or not. Who knows, right? I like the fact that the Buddha says this so clearly. Like, don't waste your time thinking about this, because there's so much that goes on even in various forms of Buddhist practice where this is like a big thing, right? All the steps that go on, and it's like, don't go there. Don't spend any time looking at this, because you're better off just watching your breath or something, right? Then we come. This is another interesting one. And this is this man has come and to talk to the Buddha, and he's just lost his son. His son has just died, and he's really upset, and he's trying to, you know, get the Buddha to explain things to him or make him understand, right? And then that householder went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One said to him, "Householder, your faculties are not those of one in control of one's own mind. Your faculties are deranged." So the guy is really... "How could my faculties not be deranged, venerable sir? For my dear and beloved only son has died. Since he died, I have no more desire to work or to eat. I keep going to the charnel ground and crying, 'My only son, where are you? My only son, where are you?' So it is, householder, so it is. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear. Arise from those who are dear." As soon as you have relationship with another human being, or another being, it doesn't have to be your dog. How people feel when their dog. I remember when my cats passed, it was like, oh, it was just horrible. I had two cats, one that lived to 18 and one that lived to 17, and it was just like, destroyed me for a day or two afterwards. I was like so sad and upset with what was going on. Anyhow, but it's like, what the Buddhist point is to here is, we're all going to experience other things, other beings who are dear to us, passing, dying. It's another part. Not only am I going to die, but all of the people around me are going to die. And either they're going to die and I'm going to experience that, or the reverse, I'm going to die and they're going to have to deal with that. And it's like built in to the system again. As soon as you have any sort of relationship with anyone, one of you is going to die and the other one's going to still be around. That's a built right in automatic. On one of my long retreats, I had really sort of strong experiences about this. I was, it's hard to explain these, what was going on. I wasn't like dreaming, and I wasn't thinking about it or imagining any of these things. I was having these experiences, it's the only word I can use, where at first it was like I was dying and my wife would be there and she would be really upset. But I'd be like, oh well, I'm dying, it's like time to go. I was fine with it, but I was upset because she was upset. And then things flipped over and now she was dying and I was there. And I was still upset because now it was, she was dying, right? No matter which way I went with this, no matter how these experiences came steadily for a couple of days, like 7 or 8 or 9 of them, one right after, you know, during long sitting periods. I was sitting for like an hour and a half, so I had some really, really long sitting periods. And this would come up over and over and over. Look, this is what death is about. This means one of you is going to be around and the other one's going to suffer. And you're going to suffer because you're worried about the other one. It's just built into any relationship, whether it's with, you know, your partner or with your kids or with your cat or whatever. Your parents, you know, whatever. Just it's built right in. It's like part. And this is, and Buddhist says it right. This, if you have relationship with someone else, this is what's going to happen. Don't pretend it's not. Don't pretend that somehow you're going to be immune to this. I mean, people, and this is why some people become monastics, right? They become monastics, then they have no relationship with anyone, they think. And then they don't have to deal with this anymore. But I was reading a book with a group of monastics and how upset they would get when another of the monastics would pass. Same story. Now it's like it's not my blood family or my marriage family or something like that, but it's like still it's a group of monastics living together. They're a family, and it was the same thing that happened. Exactly the same thing that happened as if your sister had passed, your blood sister had passed, or whatever, or your blood brother had passed. You can't avoid this. I suppose if you're a hermit and you go live out in the forest and not talk to anybody for 40 years, maybe you can avoid it. But other than that, there's no way around this issue. And so then the question becomes, why? Why is it that these things affect us so much? This is from Joseph Goldstein's The Experience of Insight. And he's talking about, you know, the ways we cling. The second noble truth, right? We suffer because we cling, right? The fourth of the bonds and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to the belief in self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there's some permanent entity in the mind-body, which is experiencing all of this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion, for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves about it, tying the bonds even tighter to this mass of pain. So if I believe I'm a separate self, or I believe that other person is a separate self, and there's any sort of connection, that's when the reason we suffer is we believe that these things are separate, that this is, the difficult thing is on the level of relative reality, yeah. These are separate beings, and one's going to miss the other one, right? But the more we can tune into this idea that, you know, there is no separation, then ideally, speaking ideal here, like absolute reality instead of relative reality. This other person would pass and would be like, oh, that's just the nature of things. It's like that person arose, who was there for a while, and now it's gone. It has the potential to take the sting out of it, I think, is what I'm thinking here. Because it seems so natural. It isn't like something that shouldn't be happening, which is where we get caught sometimes. In another place in Joseph's, this is in his book Mindfulness, he's talking about this idea once again of how this sense of a separate self is what causes us to suffer, and especially around these issues. And he's talking about what's called the craving for becoming, for renewed existence. This is the very basic urge or desire to be. It is desire for continuing existence, particularly in pleasant realms. Not only do I want not want to die, I want, if I, this body goes, I want to come back in an even better place, right? We may not believe in rebirth and different planes of existence, although they are mentioned often in the Buddhist teachings. But we don't have to believe in them in order to experience this powerful craving for becoming. We can see it in the planning mind, in the act of imagining ourselves in some future situation. We might be planning for something at work, or perhaps for our next vacation. It all starts with just a thought, and then weeks or months or even years later, a whole chain of thoughts and actions has materialized in our lives. Notice how often we get lost in mind fantasies of a future self. I'll do this, I'll go there. Losing ourselves in these projects is a manifestation of craving for becoming. So becoming in the sense of what I'm going to become later. In One Fortunate Attachment, the Buddha gave clear advice for freeing ourselves from this craving, that not a person revive the past or on the future build his hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Let him know that, to be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. One who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is he, the peaceful sage, has said, who has one fortunate attachment. On a more momentary level, we can see this craving for becoming in our relationship to the unfolding process itself. Even if we don't have an expectation for some big, wonderful experience, how often do we seem to be leaning forward into the next moment? As if somehow the next step, the next breath, the next sensation or thought will resolve everything, complete everything. We can see this leaning happen when we're feeling something unpleasant and watching for it to change. Interesting, huh? We can see this craving for becoming when something unpleasant is happening and we're watching for it to change. In other words, we can't just be with the unpleasant thing. Our mind is always off in the future thinking, well, now it'll go away, and I just have to wait, Or we see it when we're being with some emotion and wanting to feel it more deeply. The sense of leaning forward, anticipating the next moment, is also a kind of craving for becoming. Here we're not seeing each of these experiences simply as insubstantial, empty phenomena, arising from and passing in each moment. We're living in a world of wanting. We forget that liberation is not about becoming or getting, not about holding or craving or clinging, but about letting go. So if that's true, can we let go of all our concerns about death? Which are, talk about things that we're in the future, right? How often do we think about what's going to happen later and how it's all going to be and blah, blah, blah. Am I going to have a good death or a bad death? Or is it all going to happen like this, or is it going to go on for, years and years and years, like my father, who had Alzheimer's and took 6 years to go through this. We dwell so often in that future, and it stops us from just being in the present moment, right now. This is what's happening right now. And that, yes, that's going to happen in the future. We can't deny that. But trying to figure it out or looking to see if I can control it or have it be a certain way, or what a waste of time. What a waste of time and energy. But it's so natural, right? Because in one sense, though we try to deny it, we all know that's what's going to happen. We all know very clearly that we're all going to end up there, without exception. There's no, we can't get a pass. Also, and this is sort of the flip side of that. It's like, because we know that this has a limited, this body has a limited lifespan. Because we know that totally clearly. Doesn't that make us want to think, oh, then I better practice now because I don't really know how long, much longer I have. I don't really know how things are going to change tomorrow where I can't practice anymore. So it's like understanding and knowing that and accepting that that's, the result of birth is aging and death. Knowing that sort of spurs us to sort of, well, get onto your horse and get going here. Take this practice really seriously because you don't know how long you've got. You might think, oh, that's not going to happen for another 20 years like I did back there when I was not understanding impermanence other than as an interesting theory. But we don't know. We really have no clue. So that should encourage us in some sense to practice more. There is one other interesting thing in the sutta I want to talk about. This is something the Buddha taught. This is from the Satipatthana Sutta. And one of the sections in the Satipatthana, the section on mindfulness of body, right, is to contemplate a body dissolving, a corpse. It's called the nine charnel house, charnel ground contemplations. I won't read you the whole thing, but it's basically, he starts out and says, well, there's a body's 1 or 2 days dead, and see already how it's changing. And then, look a week later, and remember that often what they did outside each village, there's what was called a charnel ground, where they didn't bury people, they didn't put them in the river, they just put them onto this space out of town, and the bodies would eventually disappear, literally. And he goes through in this teaching all the various stages of what happens to a body, till at the end it says, again, as though we were to see a corpse thrown aside in the charnel ground, bones bleached white the color of shells, bones heaped up, bones more than a year old, rotted and crumbling to dust. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. This is why the Buddha encouraged this. It's because it made people realize very clearly that this is exactly what's going to happen to you. And he sees, I mean, it's kind of, he goes through all these stages where crows and hawks are chewing on the body and pecking up, but it's like that's what he wanted people to see. Like, this is what's happened to this thing you think is so precious, this body. Now it's just something that's rotting and convenient food for predators. Nothing more than that. And we have to, that's inevitable. You know, in our culture, we have to sort of, you know, go through, make sure people get buried and or get cremated and, you know, go through all this ritual, which is good because we don't really want corpses lying around. It's not very healthy. And, you know, back in those days in India where there wasn't that many people, relatively speaking, this was sort of probably a less unsanitary process than, how can we do that? We couldn't do this today. We have to have what we have. But it's just interesting to me that the Buddha encouraged this idea of actually contemplating. Like, you tell, you know, monks to go sit in a charnel ground. That's where your practice was. You'd go hang out in the charnel ground. I'm not recommending it. I've spent some time in anatomy labs with, you know, people with dissecting corpses. It's, you get to see it. It's like, you know, you peel off the skin and underneath, you know, that could be a piece of, you know, roast pork. That muscle I'm very carefully looking at. It doesn't look any different than, you know, the meat you see on the shelf at the grocery store. Oh, it's just the body at this point. This is something interesting to study. And I was learning, studying anatomy in this way. Then there's, what did the Buddha say himself when he was getting close to death? So one of the last times the Buddha taught before he died, his Sangha had got together and they were all going, oh, what are we going to do? You're going to leave us and we don't know what we're going to do. And therefore, be ye lamps unto yourselves, be a refuge to yourselves, hold fast to truth as a lamp, hold fast to truth as a refuge. Look not for refuge in anyone besides yourself. We all have to do this on our own. We can't pretend somehow that because the Buddha is not with us anymore, well, he's been not with us for 2,600 years, right, that we can't do this anymore. He kept, and he was pointing, this is like the people who'd been with him for a long time. Some of his students had been with him for 40 years. I'm not, you have to take care of yourself. You have to be a lamp unto yourself. And it's interesting, the image of the lamp, it's also something that occurs in a lot of different, you know, spiritual traditions, you know, and in cultural language, you know. Don't hide your light under a bushel. You know, common English phrase. You know, this, you know, is a song I used to sing in church school. You know, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. You know, I'll spare you the singing part, but it was like that's. We were all, had to acknowledge we were lights. The Buddha was enlightened. That's interesting, common in our language. And one other thing I think is interesting is how this practice is, in a sense, is simply preparing us for the moment we die. Interesting thought. What's it going to be like the moment, that moment? And we don't want to sort of dwell on it and, you know, make it into like a big deal. But can we sort of, when as we age more and as our body starts to, you know, really stop functioning, which is what all bodies do, can we keep our practice? It's what we're doing, learning how to practice and be aware that that's what's going to happen. Can we make that be part of our practice? Know that that's there. And so that when the time comes, when it is there, that we can still be still and calm and focused. Just interesting question for all of us to think about. This is once again Joseph Goldstein. It's from The Experience of Insight. On one level, this insight is recognizing the inevitability and imminence of our death. In the Bhagavad Gita, the question is asked, of all the world's wonders, what is the most wonderful? The answer, that no man, though he sees others dying all around him, believes that he himself will die. Interesting. But it was a pretty good description of how people function in the world, right? Each of us has deeply ingrained patterns which bear witness to everything we do. Often these are destructive habits like anger or self-pity. But in just the same way, we can learn to keep in mind the awareness of death and have it bear witness to all of our actions. If we take death as our advisor, we live each moment with the power and fullness we would give to our last endeavor on earth. If we can keep in mind the fact that we could die at any moment, can that make us try and make every moment as perfect as we can? When we keep death at our fingertips, we become less involved, less compulsive about the satisfaction or gratification of various desires in the moment. When not so clouded by desires and fantasies, we're less inclined to hold on to something, more open to love and generosity. The awareness of death provides the space of clarity in which we can understand the process of who it is we are and who it is that dies. I saw this a few years ago, a member of the Sangha who I had spent some time with, and he had got a diagnosis, and he was like, all of a sudden he was going to be dead within 3 or 4 weeks. It was like quite sudden. And he asked me to come over, and he had this big pile of stuff he wanted to give me. He knew I liked books, and he had this huge pile of books. And some of these I was like, I don't want that book. But I'll take those. I got a complete set of the works of William Shakespeare from him, for instance. I mean, that I would probably never read, but I mean, it's like he wanted to be generous. He wanted to give all this stuff away to people who would really enjoy it. That was his. He was quite awake in that sense, that he said, can't just let this stuff pile up. I'm going to give it to people who want it and who will use it. That's right. A sweet half hour or so I spent with him. He was really exhausted and I had to go. And he was just like, oh, here, how about this one? You really like this one. He was just very awake about the whole thing. Insight into impermanence on this level is the awareness of the transitory, temporal nature of all phenomena from moment to moment. In every moment, the mind-body process, our entire universe, is arising and passing away, dying and being reborn. Interesting way to think about it. I'm dying right now. I'm dying again. Every moment. We're in the process. It doesn't stop. We work on developing a mind that is silent and still, one that is unmoving in the face of such enormous change. The whole practice evolves organically from simply being aware of what's happening in the present moment without reacting. One meditation teacher in India has said that all we have to do is sit and know you are sitting. That's where I got that quote from. Right? And the whole of Dhamma is revealed. You'll clearly see the unfolding laws of nature, and then the Dharma truly becomes your own. During this organic evolution, born of balance and detachment, many beautiful and freeing qualities of mind begin to manifest. One of these qualities is love, metta. Love for oneself in the sense of being allowing and not judging, having a spacious enlightenment in the mind, and a strong loving kindness towards others, not related in terms of grasping or need or attachment. not an interesting thing, I think. Becoming aware and being aware in the moment to moment that death is there. It's happening right now. Makes us more open-hearted towards other beings because we realize, oh, it's not just happening to me. It's happening to everyone without exception. And it makes us see the sameness of all of us. This is something that everybody experiences. And it opens our hearts to them by accepting it and taking it in. So, great, beautiful thought, I think. Then there's the Buddha's last words. This is apparently the Buddha's last words. Indeed, bhikkhus, I declare this to you. It is the nature of all formations to dissolve. Attain perfection through diligence. Keep practicing. It's in the nature of all formations to dissolve. This is the stuff. This is just a formation. It's gonna dissolve. Attain perfection through diligence. That was his last words. Just reminding them yet again. You know, pay attention to your practice. One last little bit here. This is Mary Oliver's book of poetry called Thirst. She wrote these poems in this book soon after her partner of many years passed away. And it, in a poetic way, describes what we're all going to go through, and I'll go through, have gone through many times already, perhaps. It's called Heavy. That time I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying. I went closer, and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then said my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, it's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief, it's all in the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down. So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire the things of this world that are calmed and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. Pretty clear description of the process of grief, I think, which is also part of this.